Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
From a secret studio buried deep within the Rocky Mountains comes LA Talk Radio's very own The Writer's Block, starring Jim Christina, Bobby G. Bell, and Russ Avison when he decides to show up. We bring you only the finest writers, playwrights, musicians, songwriters, and poets that can be offered in the United States and the world. So stick around, tune in, put your feet up, and have a great time. We're coming at you right now.
And we are coming at you live from my secret in the Rockies. And for those of you who are wondering, or both, I am not dead. This is Christina. I am both. And I am back from the dead hospital, and I am ready to rock and roll. I'm only going to be on 10 minutes tonight. But I'm looking forward to kind of catching up with you guys. Real small announcement before we get started. If you are going to try to call in, please, as this COVID goes and progresses in our country, and we're doing everything out of studio, you cannot call in until we are back in studio and have the studio finesse going. So if you're trying to call in, just hang up. It isn't going to work. We would love to get your calls, and believe me, we have gotten some good ones in the past, but there's nothing we can do about that, so we just have to deal with what we have to deal with. Okay. Hi, guys. Glad to be back with you.
Yay. It's Jim. Yay. Christina.
Welcome back.
Well, you know, the last time I was on, I listened to that show. I thought, holy Christ, did that guy stoned? Who is he? And I really was. I mean, I was out of my skull. But well, I'm not now. I'm back.
You were fighting there. So happy you won the battle.
I was within nanoseconds of being dead the Sunday they took me to the hospital. So I have to applaud the doctors and the nurses and the emergency care at St. Alphonsus Hospital in Nampa, Idaho, who virtually saved my life, and I thank them. I know some of the staff are listening tonight. And if you are, I really hope you understand. And thank you so much for the care that you gave me while I was in there. And one of the biggest pain in the ass patients you guys have ever seen. Okay. but anyway, thank you so much for holding down the fort, guys. The last couple shows have been marvelous. And I have no doubt that this one will be the same. Tonight, of course, is the first our first Thursday in June. And, of course, with that comes Mr. Henry Park. And Henry, hello.
Yes, sir. Hello. Jim, welcome.
So
back.
What goes on in the Western world? Thank you.
Well, I'll tell you.
Thank you.
There are few, if any, Westerns or any other movies currently in production, but there's good news nonetheless. Martin Scorsese's first Western, Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders, and The Birth of the FBI. Boy, I think they have to put all of that on a marquee. Is going ahead.
Yeah, I know.
It's cool. Based on the nonfiction book by David Graham, and all you writers take note, he sold the film right for $5 million.
Oh, wow.
Holy crap, no kidding.
Yeah. Now, it's set in the 1920s. It's the story of how the investigation into the mysterious murders of several Osage Indians brought about the creation of the FBI. It's going to star two actors he's never worked with before, Leonardo DiCaprio and Robert De Niro. Sorry. Anyway, it's going to be financed by Apple and distributed worldwide by Paramount.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, originally, Paramount was going to make the whole film as well as distributing it, which was a commitment of $180 million. But the word is they cooled when script changes turned Leo's character from a hero to, at the very least, an anti-hero.
Mm.
And Scorsese has another film in the works with Western interest, a biopic of Teddy Roosevelt. Uh-huh. To star, who do you think, Robert De Niro or Leo DiCaprio?
Oh, gotta be Leo.
It is.
Gotta be Leo DiCaprio, back in his cowboy days.
Exactly. Hop along, Leo. Yep. Well, now, how are you Gunsmoke Leo. Fans?
We call him Hoppy around the house.
That's right. Well, now, for all you Gunsmoke fans, and I assume that's just about all of you, CBS and Paramount have put out something fantastic, a boxed set of all 20 seasons of Gunsmoke. That's 143
discs. No kidding.
Wow.
Now, if you'd like to see what it
Gunsmoke
looks like.
Gunsmoke was on for 20 years. Gunsmoke was on TV for 20 years, and Gunsmoke was on TV for 20 years. And on radio for like 7. So, I mean, that's excellent.
Yeah, well, you don't get the radio with this. This is strictly the TV show, but you get every episode. Yeah.
Wow.
Now, if you want to see what this thing looks like, I've actually posted my first unboxing video on YouTube. You know what an unboxing video is?
I know they're very popular right now, but I haven't watched any of them.
They're very strange. What they are is people video themselves opening packages and describing the content. Usually it's adorable children opening toys or nerds opening cell phones. And I know it sounds dumb, but they're hugely popular. So if you want to see an old Western nerd open up 143 discs, look for it. It's out there.
Wow.
Now, the weird thing, there is no set list price. I asked how much it is because I thought I should mention it. They said, check Amazon.
Oh, wow.
So today it is $302.20. I don't know what it's going to be tomorrow. And all that I had to do to promise for them to send it to me is that I'll binge watch it and share my reactions.
Wow.
Thankfully,
they did not.
Henry, tomorrow will be 1995.
That's right. And you get the first episode of Cheers.
Yeah.
Thankfully, they have not given me a deadline on when I have to finish all of that.
Wow.
Now, the new roundup, which I'll be posting later tonight, includes my interview with Neil McDonough about his INSP West and The Warrant. The next roundup will have my interview with his co-star, Casper Van Dien. The Warrant premieres on INSP on Saturday night, June 20th.
Right.
Now, if you haven't yet, please check out the June True West, which features my article celebrating Clayton Warren, the 70th anniversary of the Lone Ranger TV series. And Jim, how long was the radio series on?
Good question.
Lone Ranger?
Lone Ranger.
I said 1937 to 1953. Wow. Is that correct?
That sounds good to me. I don't know. I was just, digging for information.
I know it was Lance Bremer was the Lone Ranger.
Brace.
Bremer. Brace Bremer. Yeah, right.
Now, also in the roundup, I've got a photo tour of the Fred Harmon Art Museum in Pagosa Springs, Colorado. Does anyone know who Fred Harmon is or was? Fred Harmon was a fine Western painter, but he's best remembered as the writer cartoonist who created Red Rider and Little Beaver. Speaking of radio, several men played Red Rider: Reed Hadley on radio, then Don Red Barry in the Republic serial. That's why he got the nickname Red. And in the features, you had Wild Bill Elliott, Alan Rocky Lane, and Jim Bannon did a bunch in color in the 50s.
Right.
And who was the most famous Little Beaver of all?
Robert Blake.
Yeah, Robert Blake.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? You can read all about this and so much more at www.henryswesternroundup.blogspot.com.
All righty. Thanks, Henry.
Thank you, Henry.
You beat a measure.
Thank you.
Stay safe, my friend.
Take care.
Done deal. Take care, guys.
Thank you, Henry.
I'm going to turn the show over to Bobby Jean and to Richard Polinelli. They'll be taking you into the science fiction world of Robert Oppenheimer, who is a
fascinating, fascinating character, not only during the Manhattan Project, but after Little Man and Big Boy were exploded and into the 1950s with the communist scare. So please, please, please give your attention to Bobby Jean Bell, Richard Polinelli, and take it away, guys.
Thank you, Jim. Hey, Richard, how are you doing tonight?
Not too bad, not too bad. I have discovered the eighth level of hell that Dante wrote about. It's called Omaha, Nebraska. But other than that, we're doing okay. It's a little warm, but we're okay.
Well, I know that you and I just were flying through the book of our guest tonight, so we're going to get right to it. And let me tell you a little bit about our guest tonight. Is author Robert J. Sawyer, called the Dean of Canadian Science Fiction by the Ottawa Citizen, and just about the best science fiction writer out there these days by the Denver Rocky Mountain News, and is one of only 8 writers in history, and the only Canadian, to win all 3 of science fiction field's top honors for Best Novel of the Year, and that includes the World Science Fiction Society's Hugo Award, Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America's Nebula Award, and the John W. Campbell Memorial Award. And if there's an award out there for this book we're going to talk about tonight, he needs to get it. We are so honored to have Robert join us just one day after his newest title has exploded onto the literary landscape, causing much excitement and garnering fantastic reviews. We're talking about The Oppenheimer Alternative. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
So, have you gotten much sleep since the book hit the press yesterday?
I have not. And that, of course, that's wonderful. I mean, I've been planning this book. This is my first book in 4 years. It's my 24th novel, but there's been quite a gap. And I was planning all sorts of things that did not get to happen because of COVID-19. I was to be in New Mexico as part of my book tour, of course, with the Manhattan Project started, Los Alamos Laboratory. I was to be touring across Canada. I live in Canada, down into the States. All of that fell by the wayside. So the fact that I've had to get up early and go to my living room to do interviews by Zoom and Skype and phone, one after the other, I'm delighted that anybody is taking any interest at all, given that there's no local news angle. You know, the reason you go on book tour, it's not so much to sell books at bookstores, that's nice, but it's so the local media will pick up and do an article about your book. And that gets lots and lots of sales from people who would never bother to come to a reading or an autograph. So I'm grateful for every bit of attention the book has gotten.
Well, and deservedly so. And I know that it took you, as you say, 4 years to write. And I know a couple of years of research. I think, is this the 75th anniversary of the releasing of the atomic bombs?
That's right. July 16th is the 75th anniversary of the Trinity test, the first atomic bomb test that happened in New Mexico. August 6th. Will be the 75th anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, the little boy bomb that was alluded to in the introduction. And August 9th, 3 days later, will be the 75th anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bomb on Nagasaki. The fat man designed this, he was there. So yes, absolutely. This is 75 years that we've lived with the specter of nuclear annihilation. We've avoided it so far. Let's hope we avoid it for all time.
Well, I know my partner here, Richard Polinelli, who is a wonderful science fiction writer, has to just be chomping at the bit. Richard, why don't you take it from here?
Well, yeah, just a little bit. It was, first off, it's an amazing book.
It is.
And I have been kind of guest co-hosting now for off and on 4 years. About 30 times. And this is only the third time I've read the book and gone and left a review for the book. So that should tell everybody just how good this thing is. But what drew you to creating an alt history sci-fi story based around the events and the person in Oppenheimer that you chose? I mean, what was the process on that?
Sure. A lot of my fiction has been about the moral responsibility of scientists. And there's nothing new in that in science fiction. It goes right back to Mary Shelley, who wrote the first ever novel mm-hmm. with a scientist as the main character, Frankenstein, and what moral responsibility he had to his creation, the Frankenstein monster.
Exactly.
And I had done what I thought I could do with novels set in the future dealing with that, and novels set in the present day. My most recent novel, the one 4 years ago, Quantum Night, set in the present day and was about the moral responsibility, in that case, of experimental psychologists. But I thought, is there somebody in the past, a scientist, who had a moral conundrum that he or she had to face that would let me again explore morals and conscience of scientific innovation? And you only have to rack your brain for 30 seconds before the name J. Robert Oppenheimer, the mm-hmm. father of the atomic bomb, leaps to mind. Well, I knew a little bit about him. Everybody does know a little bit about him. But as soon as I started digging into this guy, I found this, he was an onion, an incredibly complex, multi-layered individual, which of course made him extra special and unique. But it was fascinating to dig down through the layers and look at what drove this man to create something that ultimately killed an awful lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you really touched on a lot of the battles that were going on at the time over not only, you know, should we build it once we've got it built and we know it will work, do you use it? Do you do the demonstration test out in the middle of the ocean? And I like the way you presented all that so that the reader, if they're not familiar with this, they get a sense of what these people were thinking and what they were going through as they kind of grappled with the decision as far as what to do with this. And you presented both sides. And it to me, it made the book that much better because you really got yourself immersed into this whole process. And you mentioned that Oppenheimer was this onion, and you really brought to life a lot of the people whose names we've heard mm-hmm. connected with the Manhattan Project, with, you know, Teller, and then you had Einstein, you had Feynman, you had all these different people doing different things, and we always think of them as these scientists, but you've kind of introduced them to us as real people with mm-hmm. real people problems, and it was, I was just awestruck how you managed to do that in this book. And how did you go about, I mean, this had to involve a lot of research on each and every individual.
That's exactly right. And almost all of those main characters that you named, Teller is an example, Richard Feynman is an example, they wrote autobiographies. Leslie Groves, the military head of the Manhattan Project, wrote an autobiography. So they told us in their own words. Now, as anybody who's ever read anybody's autobiography knows, they told us in their own self-serving words.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, they at least told us what they wanted the world to think about what they were thinking. But Oppenheimer, the central figure, never wrote an autobiography. He never explained himself what he was thinking very much at all. And that invited the opportunity to really get inside his head. But to do that in any kind of plausible way, remember, his son is still alive. Lots and lots of people who were his students. He was, of course, a university professor by profession. His students are still alive. There are people who remember him, and there are historians who spent their whole career studying this guy. So I really had to dig in and read every bit of research we have on him. Now, despite the fact that he never wrote an autobiography, many aspects of his life are more fully documented than almost anybody else's life in recent history, because he was considered throughout the Manhattan Project and beyond a security risk, because he had been involved at least as a fellow traveler with the Communist Party in the 1930s. And so he was bugged. His house was bugged. His office was bugged. He was surveilled by FBI operatives and military intelligence. And there were recordings and observations and dates and logs, many of which were classified at the time. But it's 75 years later. Most of that stuff has been declassified. And there's an enormous wealth of information to draw upon. And I like to think that I did justice to this man. No one will ever know. He doesn't is not alive anymore to tell me whether I got it right or wrong. But people who knew him have told me I got it right. And that meant the world to me.
Yeah, I imagine so. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Bobby.
Well, I was just going to say there's a scene, and I am a reader and not a science person. So it was very interesting how well you explained concepts for those of us that, you know, we maybe know what a slide rule is, but we haven't touched one in years. there's a scene where there's an equation. They start thinking about equations, and I don't want to do a spoiler alert, but Oppenheimer brings something to people's attention. And it was so interesting. You know, some are writing on the chalkboard. Some, you say, even like their eyes are almost closed, but you can see the eye going left to right as they're actually seeing these equations in their heads. Others are fast and furiously working with their slide rules. And then they all come up with the same conclusion. And I think the way that you give us some of these bits of, I would say almost like stage business, almost like if we were watching in a movie, but it makes it, there's no computers at this time. And the birth of the computer kind of begins to be talked about in this book, that all of this is being done, you know, kind of the old fashioned way. I found that so interesting.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
You know, the interesting thing is that science, all that science is an exercise in simplifying things. So, you know, there's this tendency for people to think, oh, science is complex, I'll never understand it. Any good scientist or any good science fiction writer or science journalist, science nonfiction writer, can take a complex concept and, if they really understand it, make it simple and understandable to everybody. It's one of the great conundrums in science is how come our universe is so easily understandable. How, you know, you look at E equals MC squared, which is, of course, the relativity formula. Three terms, E, M, C, and two mathematical operators, equal and exponentiation for double squaring. And that's it. And that, you know, it's not pages and pages and pages and pages of math. Almost all of physics and science comes down to DNA, to four different chemicals, right? Four different chemical bases. It's easy once you understand it, if somebody is not invested in their ego in trying to make you think that it's hard. We've all met people who want to deliberately talk above other people's heads because it makes them feel special. No. A good scientist or a good science fiction writer knows how to make you feel the excitement of science the same way somebody else might make you feel the excitement of baseball, a game that also comes down to a few simple rules. And unless somebody makes it make sense to you, it's the most boring thing in the world to watch. But with the right person at your elbow in the stadium, say, no, that's a triple play. Oh, no, he's on first, he's on second, they're going to try this. Suddenly it becomes the most fast, it becomes the national pastime in the United States.
Right, right. When we talk with authors, one of the things we love to talk a little bit about is the writing of dialogue and or also character development. We follow Oppenheimer. In fact, we follow most all of these scientists over their whole adult lifespans almost. And yet I did feel some of these characters, definitely you did develop them with time. It was that a challenge or how did you approach that? Or was that even something you thought about?
Oh, 100%. I thought about it. Absolutely. And it was a challenge. And yet I don't want to overstate how difficult it was, because if I was writing about the great physicists of two centuries ago, there would be no recordings of their voices. There would be no newsreels and so forth of them. But these guys, and there would be very little in the way of print journalism where they'd given interviews and quota. But these guys, their words were written down by journalists. There were lots and lots of taped interviews and television interviews and so forth, once we had television, you know, in the 50s. So you could listen to these guys' voices. Oppenheimer is a very distinctive way of talking. Edward Teller also has a very distinctive and very different way of talking. So you listen, you immerse yourself in the way they speak when you're making up dialogue that they never really said, but you want it to sound as if it's something they would have said. You know, we all know when somebody says something, a friend of ours, that doesn't sound like you. You must be quoting somebody. Yeah, well, actually, that's Oscar Wilde. He was way funnier than I am, right? You know, the guy that you're quoting. And you can tell in an instant when somebody you know isn't talking in their natural vocabulary and cadence and accent. And I wanted to do that for each of those characters in the book. The guy who's got the real challenge now is Josh Bloomberg, who is the narrator of the audiobook, which it's already out. The novel's already out in ebook and print book everywhere. Yeah. But the audiobook comes out on the 16th of June, 2020. And Josh is desperately trying to do German accent, French accent, Italian accent, Dutch accent, Japanese accent. And he's a specialist in accents. But not only does he have to get all the words and the cadence right, he's got to get the accents right as well.
Well, and then there's often quotes in Latin or German or other languages as well. You start every chapter with a quote. Do you want to talk a little bit about how you, Richard? I haven't. With Richard, I'm sure you have something you want to say.
Well, no, I was actually going to bring up the chapter quotes too. So perfect timing. Yeah, you start each chapter off with a quote, and it's a quote that was actually, you know, spoken by the person attributed to. And we have to remember this is an alt history story as well. So you've got this little thread of something that we don't know happened. You know, this is kind of the fiction part. And these quotes that you've pulled not only apply to the actual known history, but they put a different slant on that actual known history when we apply it to what's going on with your alt history storyline. What prompted you to pull those quotes and start the chapter that way? Was it to help kind of move the alt history storyline along?
Those were the plums in the pudding, let's say. So you're reading, doing research, of course, as everybody does, you're highlighting passages in books, you're noting interesting things. And some of those quotes were just so apropos of what the book was about. There's one from Leo Szilard that has nothing to do with the alternate history plot. He says, "Come on, everybody, if the Germans had bombed Buffalo and Rochester, New York with atomic weapons, is there any question at all but that we would have tried them in war crimes trials at Nuremberg and hanged them until they were dead, the physicists who had been responsible for that," right? Mm-hmm. And he's absolutely right that what we think of as the great solving of a huge problem, if it had been done to us, we would have considered an incredible war crime. So those kinds of quotes just help frame the moral debate. Another one from Emilio Zagre, who said, "We were told this was to fight Hitler. Why are we continuing after Hitler is dead? What are we doing now? What is this all about? We were sold a bill of goods that we, you know, who are immigrants from Europe, who've escaped, either us or our families have escaped the oppression of the Nazis. We were fighting a righteous fight, and we're going to continue now that Hitler is dead and the Germans have surrendered. What's going on here?" But the ones that tied into the secret history, they just tickled me pink. Oppenheimer, when he was being called before a security review board because of his past communist associations, said to a reporter, if a reporter were to dig deeply enough, he would find that there is a story behind my story. Wow. That kind of underpins what I want to talk about. Yeah. There's an astrophysical calamity facing humanity in this. And that really, Freeman Dyson, the great physicist, one of the last Manhattan Project scientists to have been alive. He was alive until earlier this year, died at 96 this year, recognized that Oppenheimer was the first scientist to describe black holes. He had basically discovered mm-hmm. the concept of a black hole. And he really did say, you know, I kept asking Oppie, that was brilliant work. Why didn't you go back to it? And Oppie would always change the subject and refuse to talk about it. Why? Why would he be hiding? What's behind that? So these real life hints that there was something going on behind the scenes, where they get verisimilitude, which is the appearance of being real, which is what every author wants in their fiction, to what I had to say in terms of my creation for the novel. But they also just are so enticing. There definitely was some secret history behind the events that I may have stumbled on and guessed correctly, or we may eventually, when even more material becomes declassified as the decades go on, realize that it was something else you said.
Yeah. We're gonna take a quick break right there and just do a little bit of business. I'm going to tell you about a new bookshop online, and it's calling you. To all our readers, authors, and publishers out there, there's a new place to purchase books by your favorite authors and at the same time support independent booksellers in your town or nationwide. And you can even become an affiliate, creating your own annex to highlight your favorite genres and authors. Here's all you need to do. Go to www.bookshop.org to shop and be a hero to independent booksellers. Or do like we did, set up your own affiliate bookshop page. Check out ours at bookshop.org/shop/OutWestShop. And you'll find the Writer's Block, featured authors and titles, as well as personal favorites in categories like tools for writers, historical fiction, romance, science fiction, biography, history, film, cooking, and more. It's always a great day out west with these four simple steps to support authors and booksellers. Shop, open package, read, and repeat. I wanted to ask a question. We've been talking a little bit about, you know, there's an alt history that's going on there. And for the first majority of the book, we're pretty much reading we're reading nonfiction. I mean, I guess you'd have to say it's historical fiction, but we're getting the real deal. And then you begin to weave in, I kept going, okay, is this where the alt history is coming in? Is this where the alt history is coming in? And you introduce three photographs. And they kind of begin to take us into this fascinating world that we don't want to do a lot of spoiler alerts. Were those three photographs, spectrographs of the sun, were they part of real history, Robert?
The ones that Hans Bethe took are part of real history, and that Hans Bethe was wrong, even though he's the world's greatest expert in how stars work, that he was wrong about how hot our sun was. That's real. The argument between him and Edward Teller that lead them to realize, oh my God, the world may be doomed because of this, that's where it becomes fictional. And, you know, besides being a novelist, I'm also a script writer, screenwriter from time to time. And we all get taught, when we're taught screenwriting, what's called the three-act structure. And the three acts are of unequal length. They're the first quarter of the story is the setup. The next half of the story is the rising action. And the final quarter of the story is the resolution. So if you look in terms of where it is in my novel that the first twist of alternate history occurs, it's at the one quarter mark. It's the
Did we lose him?
I'm not sure. Robert, did we lose you? Let's see.
Yeah, ooh, we did. Uh-oh.
He did.
Ronan, you need to track our guest back down.
Ronan, can you call Robert back? Well, while we're waiting.
Well, that was unfortunate.
There
he is.
I don't know what happened there.
You fell into a black hole.
Yeah, I think it was the black hole.
I fell into a black hole. It's Robert Oppenheimer's revenge here. Exactly. I don't know how much of that you got. Tell me where you lost me.
Yeah, not a lot of it, I'm afraid.
Okay, well, all I was saying was that the I also do script writing, and yes. Scripts have a first act that's one quarter of the story before you have the big turn into the... Yeah. Into...
Hello? Hello? Uh-oh.
He's still hanging there. I think we're having weather issues out where he's at, so...
That could be. That
the joys
could be.
Of live radio.
Oh, is he back?
I can hear you guys just fine.
Okay, yeah. So it's just something with bandwidth or some crazy thing.
I'm telling you, Oppenheimer is not happy with you right now.
I am, you know, I mean, I'm on an actual, like, you know, you should be hearing me just fine. I don't know. We're not having bad weather here, but.
Okay.
You know, the one thing I enjoyed about this book, and it's what I like when I encounter this with science fiction writers, is they are setting things up, and about the time you think you've got it all figured out where they're going is when they take the turn on you. And you did this really well, because up until, I'd say, the last few chapters, I really thought your solution to the problem was going to be they were going to load up a whole bunch of Teller's supers, toss them into Von Braun's big Saturn rocket, use Feynman's position on positrons being able to go backwards, and do a reset so that, you know, the event they were worried about coming would never actually come. And so I go, okay, this is what he's going to do. And then we get to the end. It's like, no, that's not what he did, but it was a great ending. So I really enjoyed that you did that.
Thank you. You know, the thing is that one of the very first books written about the atomic bomb was called Brighter Than a Thousand Suns, Brighter Than a Thousand Suns. And, you know, the Earth is one millionth the size of the sun. You fit a million Earths into the sun. So no matter how many hydrogen bombs we want to throw at the sun, or even if we wanted to drive the entire planet Earth directly into the heart of the sun wouldn't even notice.
Yeah.
So I had to come up with a different solution. But you're right. Definitely some misdirection on my part to get people to, and this is what every kind of writer does. You want the people to think you're going direction A, and exactly. Then you psych them out and you go direction B. But in the end, they say, oh, why didn't I see that all along?
Exactly. Well, you wrote the ending so well, I had to actually go outside when I got done reading and look in the night sky and make sure a certain object was still the same color.
Very good. Thank you.
All right.
I was just going to say, Ronan, let's go ahead and take a step this up a bit. And can we have the LA Talk Radio ad right now, if Ronan can play that?
Hey there, J. Michael Michael here for LA Talk Radio. And you know, while you're on furlough or just playing staying home because of the coronavirus, if you're working at home, what better way to pass your day than to tune in to www.latalkradio.com and listen to some of our fine broadcasting during the day. We have a lot to offer. We have a lot on the air, so give us a listen. Right now, we've got one of your favorites. LA Talk Radio's very own The Writer's Block, and it's coming at you right now. So kick back, relax, and enjoy.
Richard, do you want to ask the question?
Oh, I get to do it two times in a row.
Of course.
Okay, Robert. The question that we ask all writers who dare enter our realm is, do you ever suffer from that dreaded, accursed writer's block? And if you do, what in God's name do you do to get rid of it?
So I had to find the answer decades ago, because you're right. It often is very difficult to continue your writing for the day. And the answer that I realized very early on, I was an early adopter of word processor technology, is guess what? You don't have to write the thing that comes next. If you've got your character hanging, as the literal example, hanging off a cliffhanger, and you don't have any idea how he or she is saved from falling off that cliff, but you know that person is going to be saved and there's going to be later scenes in the book, just skip ahead. Just skip ahead and write some other part of the book. It's not like you're at a typewriter where you're focused and you have to, in linear fashion, if you've started to type T-H and your next letter has to be E because you're typing the word the, you can go anywhere at all. That's tip number one. Tip number two is, when I do my first drafts, I am very spare when it comes to description. The dialogue will be putting in place and enough so that I know what room I'm in or where I am. But I leave the description quite bare bones. And the reason is, when I'm out of creative juices for creating a new scene, there's always a scene I can go back to and add description, add new material, revise and revamp and expand. And that gets me past the writer's block.
That's fascinating.
That works for me.
Yeah, yeah. Did you, you have a couple of women in this book that play significant roles in Oppenheimer's life. Would you just take a moment and talk a little bit about Jean and about Kitty?
Sure. And of course, this is, if one wants to take a swipe at my book, the fair swipe is it's almost all white men, which it is. That's the sad truth of the history of the period I'm writing about. And that the women have lesser roles because society forced upon them lesser roles. One of those women was Oppenheimer's wife, Kitty. Catherine was her full name. Kitty Oppenheimer. She had been studying to be a botanist. I mean, she had a bachelor's degree in botany. She wanted to eventually get a PhD in botany and be a professor in her own right. And there weren't a lot of opportunities for that. What I did contrive for Kitty's story was, like all the other wives who went to Los Alamos with their husbands, she was kept in the dark during the war about what Oppie and everybody else was working on, even though she was the wife of the director of Los Alamos. She wasn't privy to the fact that they were making a nuclear bomb, an atomic bomb. And so when I contrived that the Manhattan Project team will stay together after the war to solve another crisis, Kitty says, no way. This time I'm in there. I'm part of it. I'm a scientist in my own right. You tell me everything, and I have a major part to play. And I give her that. Mm-hmm. And she deserved it. She deserved it in the 40s, as so many women did. I was able, 75 years later, to give her what history had denied her. The other woman, very complex character and very mm-hmm. tragic character. Doctor, again, a highly educated woman, Dr. Jean Tatlock. She was an MD with a specialty in psychiatry, and she was Oppenheimer's girlfriend for a long time, and Oppie kept proposing, and she kept accepting only to break it off. And after three or four times of this, Oppie kind of threw up his hands and started brokenhearted and started dating other people. And indeed, he dated Kitty, and Kitty very quickly got pregnant deliberately, as she herself admitted at that time, to make Oppenheimer have to marry her at the time. But Oppie never lost his love for Jean. And the novel is really driven, Oppenheimer's character arc mm-hmm. is driven by the fact mm-hmm. that he had to leave Berkeley. She lives in San Francisco. She lives in Berkeley. Those who know the Bay Area know that they're adjacent to each other, right across the bridge there. He lived in Berkeley. She was in San Francisco. And when he packed up and left to go to Los Alamos, the secret lab, he couldn't even say goodbye. Couldn't tell her where he was going. Had to just disappear. And she killed herself. She took her own life. And Oppie had to bear the burden of the fact that, yes, she had all kinds of personality problems separate from him, but bear the burden of the fact that he had abandoned her and wasn't there for her when she really needed him. Mm-hmm. And that really, that tragedy, romantic tragedy, really, really propels Oppie's story. And I have to give credit because, of course, I'm a man writing a story about a main character who's a man. And one of my readers, Alicia Soule, who to whom the book is dedicated, was the one who said in reading an early draft of the book, you're missing the spine of this story. Mm-hmm. The emotional thrust of this story is Oppenheimer's relationship with Jean and his need to find a redemption, not just for himself and what he did with the atomic bomb, but for what he did in his personal life as well. And that was such a...
You know, there was another... Insightful... Okay.
Yeah. It was such an insightful revelation. I was mm-hmm. so pleased to have that. Go mm-hmm. ahead.
there was another relationship that I kind of wanted to jump in on for a couple of minutes, and it's between Oppie and Teller, who testified against him at that hearing and got his security clearance stripped from him. And then years later, Oppie is the chairman of the Einstein Award, and they give the award that year to Teller. And I'm thinking, with all the animosity that had to be going on between those two, because when Teller did that, he was basically frozen out of the physics community. They didn't want to have anything to do with him because of what he'd done. Did you ever find any indication of why Oppenheimer let that go through, or did he attempt to even stop it, or what was the process there?
And of course, I use that as a dramatic point in the novel. I suggest that Teller blackmailed Oppenheimer because he needed Oppenheimer needed Teller's super bombs for the alternate history plot that I contrive in the novel, because that's the only explanation that I could think of. You're as puzzled by it as I am. Teller had been instrumental in the ruin of J. Robert Oppenheimer. If Teller had said instead on the witness stand, "This man is a loyal American and I trust his judgment," which is not what he said. He said, "I don't trust his judgment. The world would be safer in safer hands if somebody else held the nuclear secrets instead of him." We're all baffled, and yet it may be the most forgiving thing that anybody has ever done to turn around and chair a committee years later and give the essentially the American equivalent of the Nobel Prize in Physics, the Einstein Award, to your worst enemy. Mm-hmm. And yet Oppenheimer did that in real life.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another short break. And if you're an author looking for some wonderful publicity, you may want to work with Creative Edge. Ronan, do you got that ready for us?
You know, when Creative Edge Publicity was founded in 2016, they immediately showed they weren't the same as other publicity firms. No, they work closely with their individual clients' needs and goals and push harder to get them noticed. Creative Edge believes that communication is an important part of the partnership, and that model is how they have built their success. They collaborate and work with local, national, and international media outlets and organizations to meet their clients' goals and needs. So Creative Edge, it's your brand and your future. Mickey Mickelson, publicist, www.creative-edge.services.
Creative Edge. Robert, what are you working on next?
Well, you know, we've gone through this incredible change in our lives over the last few months. We've had to learn how to deal with people at a distance instead of physically. We've had to learn how to telecommunicate and telecommute. And so I'm writing a science fiction parable or metaphor about having to essentially go back to a more direct physical existence and how people will come back to that as changed individuals. Obviously, I've got some science fictional twist to it, and it's not set in the present day, it's set in the future. But it very much is my, I think every creative person, every person of any stripe, has been spending an awful lot of time reflecting these last few months on what they really value in terms of at their homes, in their family, in their friendships, in their work, all of that having been impacted by this. And so I'm working on something that will be my fictional response to the great COVID-19 pandemic of 2020.
Mm-hmm. Richard, you got one parting question. Plus, we also would like Robert to make sure to tell people where they can find him. But have you got something you'd like to ask or share?
Well, not so much a question, it's just an observation. I mean, as science fiction writers who deal with the future and sometimes dabble in dystopia, could you ever imagine a 2020 or a year like we've had so far these first 5+ months and be able to write anything that'd be any crazier than what we've gone through?
So I hate to be the one to tell the world this, but I told you so. I wrote my last one 4 years ago. before the current administration called Quantum Night about the rise of, forgive me, a psychopath to the highest office in the land and the sparking of a trivial, and I don't say that the case of George Floyd, but it was in my novel. It was a trivial thing. It was a lost hockey game in my novel. But the same one riot leading to the next, spreading from city to city to city, leading to lockdowns and leading to armed uprising, or not uprising, but anti-insurrectionary measures by a government that is sworn, in fact, to allow peaceful protest by its people. That's my previous novel, Quantum Night, still in print, night like in, not day, N-I-G-H-T, as opposed to Knights of the Round Table. Quantum Night. I predicted this, and it gives me no pleasure, the fact that fiction became fact so darn quickly.
Yeah. I've got a story that I did something similar, and I'm wishing that people quit making my stuff come true. You know, it's supposed to be fiction, guys.
Well, let's
absolutely
hope, let's hope that Robert's suggestion of what could happen between 2025 and 2029 turns out to be fiction.
True.
Yes, an Oppenheimer alternative. That's right.
Robert, where can people find you and follow you and such?
Sure. I'm lucky enough to be the first science fiction writer in the world to ever have a website devoted to his fiction. So I got a great URL. It's ffwriter.com. S is in science, F is in fiction, writer.com, celebrating its 25th birthday this month. Wow. And on social media, it's just my name, Robert J. Sawyer, run together, no spaces, no punctuation. Twitter, Patreon, Facebook, you'll find me in all those places. I'm very active, very approachable online. Come and have a chat.
Well, we surely appreciate you being with us tonight. And oh my goodness, I know how much you're going to enjoy all of the accolades that are going to continue to come your way, because this book, to our listeners, you've got to get it. Absolutely. Download it, buy it, whatever you need to do. This is a book that you won't be able to put down, right, Richard?
Exactly. I got the book Monday morning when I found out I was going to be on, and I finished it Monday evening. So
I was still like 120 pages from the end when he's like, I finished and I wrote a review.
It's a fantastic book. And if you are a sci-fi fan of any stripe, it's something you are going to love reading.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Robert, thank you so much for being with us. We know that it's quite late where you are and you've had a long day. And we thank you for being with us, and make sure to let us know in advance of when the next one comes out so that we can get you back on the show.
It would be my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. So our guest next week is an author, Peggy, I think she would pronounce the last name Yeager, but I'm not sure. Peggy J. A-E-G-E-R. I will certainly know by next Thursday how to say it correctly. She writes contemporary romances and writes about strong women and the families who support them and the men who can't live without them. So on behalf of Jim Christina and Henry Park, Richard Polinelli, and myself, to all our author friends out there, keep writing. We'll keep reading. And Ronan, we are out of here.